Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another reality show hosted by Golden Hawk. Join Golden Hawk as she travels down the rabbit hole exploring many of life's mysteries and adventures. Because here at another reality show, we're not afraid to let our imagination soar and our intuition run wild. So relax, get comfortable, because for the next 2 hours, we're inviting you to open your heart, spread your wings, and fly. And now, here's Golden Hawk.
As the gentleman just said, I am Golden Hawk, your host for the next 2 hours. And wow, is there a lot of stuff going on the East Coast. And I'm actually really delighted. My guest tonight is a first-time guest, but he also lives on the East Coast. So I'm really excited to, you know, just share, you know, how it kind of feels to be here on the East Coast. You know, I'll be honest with you, the other day on Tuesday was really wild. When that earthquake hit, I was on Kimberly Yeager's show, she was interviewing George for the upcoming weekend, let me plug the upcoming weekend, George Kavassalis in Boston at the Marriott, Saturday and Sunday. It's so funny, I'm plugging it, I have tickets for it. And in all honesty, because of Hurricane Irene, intuitively, at least right now, I am getting that it is not in my best interest to go to Boston, which, I mean, I can't even tell you how frustrating it is, because, you know, you can't preach, listen to your intuition, and then not listen to your intuition. But boy, does it stink when your intuition is telling you something you don't want to hear. You know, my guest might even be able to share some light on that as well. Anyways, that is happening this weekend. The earthquake. So I was listening to Kimberly's show, 12:50, and all of a sudden, of course, you know, it's so funny. I'm looking at my cat who was lying on the desk, and I was listening to the show, and it started shaking. You know, but I mean, nothing major. But then I turned around and I looked at my plants behind me. They were shaking. And I was like, huh, maybe I live with my dad. Maybe dad's doing something in the garage, because the room that I have my computer in is right above the garage. Then, of course, you know, like he walks out of his bedroom, which is across the hall from me, and I'm like, oh, you're not in the garage. And then all of a sudden I hear somebody, I think it might have been George or a caller that was talking to George, go, did you just feel the earthquake? And I swear to goodness, my jaw hit the ground. I went, oh, my God. Now, part of the reason why I got a little bit shook up about it, besides the fact that we had an earthquake on the East Coast, it just so happens the night before, you know, it just so happens, I'm holding my fingers up in quotes, the night before I watch on National Geographic all the videotapes of the Japan earthquake and tsunami. Now, obviously, it was nowhere near that. I mean, that's obvious. But what's not so obvious is there's a good chance that it's coming. Meaning the changes in the planet are definitely here, because from what I've seen on YouTube, and I posted a lot of this on my Facebook, there were earthquakes along this entire, like, rim thing, starting from the West Coast, coming up all the way through America. It's the rim of one of the shelves. I'm not quite sure exactly what it is. It's all posted on my Facebook. But the bottom line is, you know, the planet's shifting, and we all know this. And, you know, I'm preparing, but, you know, you can never really know how prepared you are until the proverbial shit hits the fan. Sorry, I had to say it. So anyways, this weekend I was all excited to see George. Now we've got Irene, who is 200 miles long or big, wide. Scott, my boyfriend's like, that's bigger than Texas. So, you know, it's very interesting what's happening. You know, for us, in particular on the East Coast, and very interesting what's happening, obviously, planet-wise, because, you know, I mean, Katrina and Japan and Chile and Haiti, I'm not saying poor me, I mean, nothing like that, but I am coming into the conscious awareness that the shifting is happening, and it's happening at this point now under my feet. And, I have to be prepared for that as much as if you live anywhere else on the planet. I would definitely, you know, invite you to be prepared for the changes that are going to happen in your lives and under your feet. So let's bring on my guest. He's a first-time guest, and it was really interesting because he wrote a book called Explaining Unhappiness, Dissolving the Paradox. And you guys know me. I mean, you're my loyal listeners. I love paradoxes. So just when he was saying dissolving the paradox, I read some of the book. I didn't read all the book, but I was really I liked what I read. And when I spoke with him, I really liked the energy that I felt after speaking with him. This gentleman, I'm going to let him tell you. Let me unmute him. Wait a minute. Blog Talk Radio is moving.
Yes, I'm
here.
Hey,
you're here. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show. So wait. Peter, Spinogatti?
Yes.
Wonderful.
Spinogatti.
Yeah, so delighted to have you on the show. And, you know, I definitely want to talk about the book, but like I said, you know, you're in New York. I'm a big fan of current events, you know, speaking on things that are happening right now as well, you know, just to bring a perspective. So, well, first of all, welcome to the show. I'm delighted to have you here tonight.
And I'm delighted to be here. Incidentally, my experience is exactly yours. I was sitting in my office, I felt these tremors, and I had a dryer on at the time, and I said, no, this could be the dryer, and then it turned out to be an earthquake. It's the first time I've ever experienced one. It's a very interesting, experience, you know.
Yeah, right.
And then we're expecting a hurricane Sunday. Okay.
Right, exactly. We're on the East Coast for a reason. Our earth stays still.
Where are you located, Golden? What town?
I'm in Connecticut, in Norwalk.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm in...
Stamford, yeah.
Yeah, I'm in Dix Hills in Long Island.
Yes, I used to date a gentleman in Dix Hills. I
oh,
know
really?
It well, and yeah.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, and I'll be honest with you, just... I really believe that whatever is going on, you know, deep within the crust, because one of the videos that I posted on Facebook was showing that there were two other days, one having something to do with the comet and another having something to do with some other alignment, where if you went to the earthquake page and you went to the page with all the charts, every single chart was blackened with how much activity was going on within the earth. I mean, and it wasn't just one or two charts. These are charts where, you know, they have the seismatic, I hate details about knowing how to say words. The Geiger counters, that's it, where they have Geiger counters placed all over the planet. This gentleman was showing that on two particular dates, every Geiger counter across the planet went off the shelf, off the hook of, you know, activity. And I'm like, you know, the truth is nobody's speaking about this. You know, Fox News isn't speaking about this. You know, WPIX isn't speaking about this. It's like, you know, I just get the sense of, you know, I can feel it inside my being, the changes that are kind of gurgling in the planet. And all the teachers and wisdom people that I follow now are really saying, go within. If you want to know your truth, go within, because it will, like I said, this weekend I'm supposed to go see, you know, a really beloved man who I follow wholeheartedly. I love his message. But my heart is saying, no, stay close to home this weekend. You know, there are things trumping even the love of, you know, wanting to see, you know, somebody who I, you know, who I adore, and I was very much looking forward to seeing him. He lives in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? This is the trump is that, you know, we're closing in on, you know, a time frame where the earth is going to go through tremendous changes. And I know that, you know, your book is definitely more from the perspective, and I promise you we'll get to it, the perspective of interrelationships and things of that nature, which are very important as well. But everybody on my show knows I'm always talking about the galactics and all that good stuff. So you know, I just had to share that because we had so much happening this week on the East Coast.
Yes, indeed.
You know,
yeah, I understand.
Okay, I appreciate that. So, okay, but I'll be honest with you. I was really, I was very much intrigued. I really do. I love paradoxes, dissolving them or otherwise, just bringing them up to even recognize that we have paradoxes, because it really brings up the awareness that something is not either or, but it's and. You know, it's this and that.
Yes.
So with that, would love to have you, you know, explain unhappiness.
All right. It would be my pleasure, Goldie. Okay.
Thank you.
Goldie,
thank
or
you very
Golden?
Much.
How you address?
No, my friends all call me Goldie, so please call me Goldie.
Oh, okay. My pleasure. Okay. Well, the reason why I wrote the book you may have noticed, for example, in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been an absolute deluge of books written out there on happiness. But it occurred to me a while ago that none of these books ever addressed the question of unhappiness, the very problem that these books was designed to remediate. So I wanted to fill that void. But more importantly, after 30 years of talking to unhappy people, I decided I was in the unhappiness business, and I said, well, let me take a look at this question of unhappiness. It seems to be a very complicated thing. So I looked at it in a way, and I said, well, because these books, in effect, if they're talking about, they usually fall into two categories. Either they give you surveys as to what kinds of groups of people are more likely to be happy, you know, if people are more likely to be happy, or religious people, or what's the relationship with money. And I thought they were all asking the wrong questions, because really, if you're talking about happiness, they're talking about remediating something for a condition that hasn't been diagnosed, so they're offering prescriptions. So I said, wait a minute, but what is the nature of unhappiness? And then it also occurred to me, I said, you know, unhappiness is very much like holding your breath. And so really, they don't have to teach you how to breathe. That's what these books are trying to do. The question should be, well, why are you holding your breath? So there's something to undo as opposed to do.
Right on.
See what I'm saying? So I said, why are you holding your breath? So all these books just simply assume, well, you know, you have to be told what to do to be happy. So I said, okay, let me talk about this. Let me look at this question. Because after all, I'm in the unhappiness business. I mean, that's what any therapist or any counselor is in the unhappiness business. It's as central to my field as disease is to medicine. I mean,
right.
That's our field. And
that's
so it seems to be a very complicated issue. Well, what is the nature of unhappiness, right? That's the question I'm asking. Now, that seems to be a rather large bite. I mean, how do you define something like that? It seems to be so complicated. But anybody who comes to me or anybody in my business is unhappy by definition, right? In the same way they go to a physician because there's an ailment. If they didn't have a disease.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, yes. Do me a favor real quick, just explain what you do for a living, because I didn't.
Well,
I was a
psychotherapist for 30 years and a marriage counselor. You know, I was also a college instructor, and now I'm doing life coaching. But it's essentially the same thing. And there's a reason why, well, I'll tell you if we have time why I transferred into life coaching, because it seems to me, in other words, that's what I did for a living, you know, for 30 years. So, in effect, I was in the unhappiness business. Right?
Right.
Now, unhappiness is different from a physical ailment because a physical ailment is something that happens to you. It befalls you. But unhappiness is a little more subtle. It's something that we kind of do to ourselves. We're not completely convinced of that, but it would appear that would be the case, right? Because if people didn't believe they were doing it to themselves, there'd be no justification for seeing a counselor or reading a self-help book, right?
Right.
So
right.
Somehow, say, okay, well, so then what is the nature of unhappiness? Okay. Well, the first thing to do is to say, well, okay, what when a person says they're unhappy, what are they saying? Well, they're saying they're feeling bad. And I mean, it would be a perversion of language to say that if anybody's unhappy, that they're feeling in a way they would like not to feel if it were possible not to feel that way.
Okay.
That's what we mean by feeling bad.
Okay.
Okay, so I mean, that would seem to be a universal definition. I don't think anybody could argue with that. So then I took a look at it, and I said, well, wait a minute. There's an awful lot of different manifestations of unhappiness. I mean, there's something, first of all, just take all the negative emotions we have. I mean, every negative emotion is a state of unhappiness, obviously, but they seem to have different causes, it would appear, right? Because any nameable emotion seems to be different from another emotion because of the cause. Like, for example, the cause of jealousy is not the same as the cause of resentment. The cause of resentment is not the same cause of embarrassment, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, okay.
So I was posing the question. I said, wait a minute. Suppose there was a psychological common denominator, a sine qua non, an indispensable requirement without which you couldn't experience any of these negative emotions. I said, if such a thing existed, that would be worth knowing, wouldn't it?
Indeed.
Indeed it would be. So I said, that would be a very parsimonious, very economical account of a theory of an emotion. So I said, you know, and I'm glad to tell you I discovered one.
Yes. I'm glad you're on the show then.
Okay. So let me tell you what I discovered.
Okay.
I know. Okay. All right. So the question, I said, well, all right, let me see how I can explain this. Let me see if I can concretize my what I'm just saying. Okay. The question is there a psychological common denominator, a sine qua non, an indispensable requirement without which a negative emotion couldn't occur? That's the question I posed myself. So let me give you a concrete example as to show how that works. You know, most people have a rather sort of a vague idea of what emotions are. You know, they believe, for example, that there's a sort of a vague idea what seems to happen to them. They don't know exactly. They know to have something to do with it, but they believe, among other things, that events in and of themselves cause them to be unhappy. They may think this, their childhood has something to do with it, or they may believe that, it's some sort of biochemical imbalance, or they may believe, for example, that it's a genetic thing, that sort of thing. And so they're not quite clear as to why it is they get unhappy. And all these other explanations, I will, if we have time, we'll discuss. But I spent a chapter on each one of these things. But anyway, okay. So let me see if I can concretize my point. Okay. Now, over the years, I've dealt with an awful lot. I mean, needless to say, if I'm in the unhappiness business, that means I've dealt with any number of negative emotional states. So let's take the question of jealousy. I think you would agree that jealousy is a very unpleasant state of mind.
Yes.
The French have said that this, the surest sign that you love somebody is that you're jealous, and the French have it wrong. The surest sign.
I agree that's wrong.
Absolutely wrong.
I have always said that that's an insecurity, not a stamp of saying, yes, that means you love me.
Right. You're right on the money. In other words, jealousy is the surest sign you feel inadequate.
Exactly.
That's what jealousy is. So let me tell you how this plays out. So, you know, to prove that somehow it is a psychological common denominator. So, over the years, I've dealt with this question of jealousy in any number of times. But a more recent example, I'll give you a case in point. A woman comes to see me, and she says, you know, and she's very explicitly, she says, listen, I am destroying myself with jealousy, and I'm destroying my marriage. Now, if you've ever been married or involved with a jealous person, she's absolutely correct, because jealousy invariably engenders suspicion, and then she subjects her partner, her husband, to all kinds of interrogations, asking where he's been, what he's done, et cetera, et cetera. Now, in the vast majority of cases, it's been my experience that nobody's doing anything, but he's put in the impossible position of trying to just defend himself against something he's not doing and has not done.
Okay.
All right. So she told me about an incident. She said she went to a party with her husband. And during the course of the evening, her husband ended up talking to this attractive woman. Now, I'm going to describe to you precisely what happens in a person's head in order for them to become jealous. And this is not culture-specific, not gender-specific. I'm offering it as a universal explanation.
Okay.
So what does a jealous person do in their head in order to become jealous is the question, right?
Okay.
Fair enough?
Okay. Fair enough.
Fair enough. So she looks at her husband, and she decides to compare herself to this woman. Now, people who are jealous never compare themselves to somebody who they believe is their inferior. They compare themselves to who they believe are their superior. So she decides that this woman is more vivacious, that she's more attractive, she's sexier, et cetera, whatever. Now, that's not a problem yet, but she does one other thing while she's doing it. She puts herself down when she makes the comparison. She feels bad about the fact that this woman is superior to her in all these areas. Because you can make a comparison with other people. As long as you're not feeling bad by the comparison, then you can't feel jealous.
Indeed. That's all a right. Subtle point that I like it, yes.
It's very, very important. Okay, so this is what happens. So she makes a comparison. Now, her understanding of it is something like this. She says, well, if my husband hadn't been talking to this attractive woman, she wouldn't have become jealous. It's a rather primitive, simplistic understanding, but she's just reacting to the observable. Then she believes the solution to her problem is to get him not to, or at least prevent him from talking to attractive women, which puts enormous strain on the relationship. Now, let me tell you exactly what does happen. So she says, well, if he hadn't been talking to her, she wouldn't be feeling this way. It's a simple cause and effect relationship in her mind. But that's not what happens at all. Here's what happens. The whole experience happened before she even went to the party. She already believed about herself that she was inadequate, that she was less than desirable. And that prefigured her response, so that when she sees her husband talking to this woman, she instantly uses that as proof that she's not desirable. So the belief that she's inadequate predisposes her to misinterpret the fact that he's talking to this attractive lady.
Right on.
You see what I'm saying? So the event is that when a woman suspects, or anybody for that matter, suspects that they're less than desirable, that they're inadequate, that already prefigures how they're going to respond.
Right.
Right. So now here's what happens next. Now, I'll show you what I mean by how this is the psychological common denominator. Now, all she has to do at that point is simply to focus on another feature of the environment. Namely, suppose she starts focusing on her husband, and now she can start to feel resentment. Now, suppose she focuses on what other people may think about her husband talking to this attractive lady, and now she can start to feel humiliated. You notice the psychological common denominator, the sine qua non, as it were, predisposes her to feel jealousy when she focuses on the woman, resentment when she focuses on the husband, and humiliation when she focuses on what other people may think.
Okay.
All of which, these are all three nameable emotions, all of which were only made possible because she already believed there was something about her that was inadequate. If she didn't believe that, none of these emotions could have taken place. Follow me so far?
Yeah, beautifully.
Okay, now my question is, wait a minute now. Suppose it turns out that this belief that they were less than desirable, that the belief that we're inadequate, the belief that we're bad, prefigures our whole emotional life. Because as soon as you believe that about yourself, you've opened up a Pandora's box of all kinds of other negative emotional possibilities. So now suppose it turns out that all our emotions are prefigured by this one psychological common denominator. That would really be worth knowing.
Indeed.
And so I spent 60,000 words saying, yes, that's exactly what happened.
So wait a minute. And I love it, and we can definitely spend more time talking about it. I'm just curious, though, so what is the paradox that you dissolve?
Okay, now this is going to get a little heady, so bear with me, okay?
No worries.
Okay, I got you. Now we're heading in some sort of heady intellectual waters. Okay, look. Now, my whole thesis is that a person, that all our misery, all our unhappiness comes from our self-doubt.
Okay.
If we accepted ourselves, which is what every psychotherapy school that I'm aware of tries to aim at, if we accepted ourselves, if we didn't define ourselves as less than perfect, if we didn't say there's something here to be desired, we'd be fine.
Right.
I'm using my example, for example, if this lady hadn't defined herself as inadequate, none of these negative emotions could have occurred, right?
Right. Because they're really only occurring in her. They're not necessarily the truth anywhere else.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's an expression. You've heard it. And so let me refine this concept. You've heard that perception is reality. Well, let me refine that concept. Also, but perception is a function of how we perceive ourselves. So we see the events filter to how we see ourselves.
Yes.
And this jealousy would be a perfect example. So if we didn't see ourselves in some sort of defective way, how will we perceive the world? Well, we'll perceive the world the way it is. We're not going to measure it against what's wrong with us.
Right.
See what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
All right. So it all comes down to this. So the whole point is that we believe, and this is normal, incidentally. Normal meaning not that this is how it ought to be. This is how most people define themselves. In varying degrees, virtually everybody you've met and everybody I've met define themselves as somebody who's less than desirable. I mean, have you ever heard any? I've done this as an experiment, and let me tell you how it turns out. I've said to people, you know something? And I say this with total conviction and honesty. I say, you know something? There's absolutely nothing wrong with you. There's nothing about you should apologize for. That you are perfectly who you are. Now, you're never going to get the response. Never. I've never seen, oh, I know that. What you're going to get is you're going to get people who get angry at you. They're going to get annoyed. They start to giggle. Because nobody, as far as I know, has ever said, no, I'm perfectly fine the way I am. Because if you did, you wouldn't need people like me, and you wouldn't have to read a self-help book, correct?
Right.
Because
right.
In effect, if you were at peace with yourself, you were self-accepting, if you were confident with who you are, well, then you don't need these services. So I would say that everybody, as far as I know, in varying degrees, has some suspicion that they're not as good as they might be.
Okay.
Okay. So self-doubt is the source of all our misery. I mean,
okay.
That sounds like a mouthful, but that's what the book is about, right?
Which is, yeah.
I mean, I even constructed a little formula. The belief that we're bad plus focus equals nameable emotion. In other words, if you didn't believe you were bad, believing you're bad plus whatever you focus on will give you the bad feeling. That's the nameable
right.
emotion. Like you believe that you're bad, you focus on the woman, that's jealousy, et cetera, et cetera. We get my
okay.
point?
I see. Yes,
okay.
yes.
So far, so good.
Yeah,
so now,
I love your descriptions. They're beautiful. So,
well, I'm a very rational person. I mean, I take the view that unless you can support what you say, shut up. And so I.
You're so New York. I love it.
Well,
and
you
Long
know,
Island on top of
that's
it.
That's how I look at life. You know, I mean, when you write a book or when you think, you say, wait a minute, you're saying something, and then I think a lot of people do this, but then what they automatically do is, wait a minute, can I support this? Is there something about what I just said that doesn't hang together? So if I
right.
say to you, belief that you're bad plus focus equals nameable emotion, I said, is that true? Can I think of any exception? I've never found one.
Right.
I mean, does that really prefigure your emotional life? And I say, well, I've never seen an exception, and if you could provide me with an exception, then I'll back off and I'll modify what I'm saying. I mean,
right.
that's how I think
right.
a rational person should behave. Do you
well,
agree?
Well, I absolutely agree. And see, one of the things that's so interesting, and it's so funny because I was already tuning into you today. I have had a fascination with human behavior all of my life.
Like me.
Very much like you. And it's interesting because there was a point in time when I was choosing what I was going to do for college, and I thought about psychology. And now, I didn't go to college until I was 30, but
mm-hmm.
I thought about actually doing psychology, and somebody told me, if you do psychology, you're going to be around, you know, a very negative environment because exactly like
That's
what you're
true.
Saying. And
That's
what I
true.
Did is I took the psychology and I became a nanny. Because I got to utilize it, you know, to know what was age appropriate, what you know, I could educate them. But the truth was, I got to play all day, which what the nature of that makes me really expand and feel joyful is play. I mean, I play on my own, I play with the kids. That's just a part of me that I knew had to be incorporated into something I was going to do for 60, 70 hours a week. At the time that I was doing it, so.
Mm-hmm. Did you pursue it, Goldie, the psychology?
Well, there were some elective classes that I took psychology as child
mm-hmm.
psychology, but no, I took early childhood education instead.
Okay.
As a major. But I'll be honest with you, not only am I fascinated with human behavior, I had an awakening of sorts, and when I was 30, I had 2 years of regular therapy, what I would call just a therapist that would talk with me.
Mm-hmm.
Got me to a very distinct point in my emotional growth. And then I wanted to get more effective, so to speak, so I went for another 2 years of hypnotherapy.
Oh, you did?
Because I found that the hypnotizing me actually took the charge out of my physical being when I was talking about whether, you know, because I was a drug addict and I was molested as a kid and... You know, you're typical, okay, you know, I'm a little whack job, so to speak. And yet the core of me kept saying, find out more about this because you're going to find you're not as wacky as you think in the sense that at this point in my existence, I'm 46, I basically had this awakening at 30, I have come to the conclusion that, you know, a lot of people believe that the cards they're dealt in life, especially from an emotional/belief system, is what they're dealt is all that's who they are. You know, if you were born a Catholic, well, you could never really convert because it's what you are. It's who
mm-hmm.
you are, and
yeah.
and I really believe that the experiences I went through were to show, and I was at the bottom of the barrel. I was, you know, smoking base cocaine for several months and doing cocaine for several years. I hit a bottom that most people, to be quite honest, I could have easily died from.
Mm-hmm.
And now here I am. I'm healthy, and I'm not ashamed of it. I mean, shame was a major part that I had to conquer. All of these, though, helped me redefine who I am, knowing that, okay, because, and it came from the core belief of that, first of all, I deserve to live a life of and not just happiness, because I personally, when you were talking about everybody in the New Age world, they are, like, gagging me with this happiness bliss. I mean, I just posted on Facebook the other day that I'm all about freedom and sovereignty. I know I'm getting a little bit off topic in the sense of, see, because everything you're saying is so brilliant, because what you're sharing here today and what I want my audience to know is, by listening to you, I'm really understanding, you speak of the negativity is in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
The knowing who we are is in our heart.
Yes.
And yes, by knowing this, and I'm going to absolutely let you talk, but I want my audience to know, when you drop into the heart from the mind, all this fear about mind control and all these things that, you know, the galactics are coming and they're going to control our mind, they can only control your mind when you're coming from the perspective that your mind is directing your reality. If you're in the perspective of your heart, it will not affect you, because the heart knows that we are deserving, we are loving, and we are perfect, exactly as we are, with pimples and cellulite and you know, all the beautiful things that make us uniquely us.
Yes,
you know, very simply.
Self-acceptance, that's what we're talking about.
Exactly. So, I'm so delighted. Please continue, because you're
we're on the same page, Goldie. We really are.
Absolutely.
You know? But maybe I can refine a couple of concepts. Okay. So
okay.
Now the question. So you're asking me about this question of paradox. Now, I don't want to get too overly intellectual about this, but I'll do my best.
Okay.
Because first of all, let's talk about what a paradox is.
Okay.
A paradox is a damned if you do, damned if you don't. That's what a paradox is, right?
Okay. Well, that's
a paradox
language.
Is as well. I mean, that's where the paradox is. Now, if you look at, I've studied. I've always been interested in philosophy, because I thought that, well, they do something for me. They give you a certain analytic skill, a certain way. And if you look at the word a paradox, it's something that mathematicians and philosophers have been dealing with for years. And it has enormous implications for mathematics, logic, that sort of thing. Okay.
Right.
So I'm saying, okay, well, let's take a look. I'm maintaining that we believe that there's something about us that's bad. We believe there's something about us that's not quite right. Right?
Okay, right.
Well, in effect, we are self-distrusting. We don't trust ourselves to know the truth when we hear it, right?
Mm.
Put a finer point on it, when a person is not trusting themselves, they suspect that they may be a liar, that we can't trust ourselves to know the truth when we hear it. If it bit us, we wouldn't know it. So I say, okay, which means that if you suspect that you're not telling the truth, like let's take you and I right now, let's pin it down to concrete reality. You and I are talking to each other, and you and I are talking to each other with the best of possible intentions.
Okay.
I believe that what I'm saying comes from my heart, and I'm being honest, and I think I'm being truthful. And you believe the same thing.
Correct.
Now, if you and I continue to live our lives that way, we would never have a problem, would we? I mean,
agreed.
We say, listen, I mean, what's not to love? You know, it sounds almost Jewish. What's not to like? I mean, come on. Okay.
Yeah.
So what happens? So most people, in varying degrees, believe that somehow. I mean, just think of the whole idea of defense mechanisms. I mean, that Freud talked about, which was quite brilliant. But defense mechanisms rest on the idea of what they call repression, which means that there are things. Repression means things about us that we dare not think about, that we hate about ourselves. So instead of facing that, we develop all kinds of defense mechanisms like projection, rationalization, denial, that sort of a thing. But none of those defense mechanisms would make any sense if we didn't make the first mistake by saying, well, wait a minute, why are we assuming that there's something about us that we have to hide? What is there about us that we have to apologize for? Right?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I'm going to say something. I hope I don't lose you, I'm not being patronizing. I mean, it's really a complicated idea. Look, if you believe you're a liar, right?
Okay.
If you believe you can't be trusted to tell the truth, you have ensconced yourself in what is known as a liar's paradox. This comes back from ancient Greece. Now, if you are a liar and you're telling the truth about the fact that you're a liar, then the statement is false. On the other hand, if you are a liar and you're lying about the fact that you're lying, then the statement is true. You follow me? I know.
But first of all, you are talking to a very, I'm a deep thinker, so you are so on the right show here, my friend.
Most people don't take it to this level, you know what I'm saying? So what happens is that when you say you're a liar, what you've embroiled yourself in the paradox. There's no solution to that. So what is the solution to a paradox? I mean, if I'm telling the truth, the statement is false. If I'm lying about the statement is true. So, there's no way of resolving a paradox. There's no way of saying, okay, well, how do you get out of this paradox? There's only one way. You know what it is?
Please share.
You can't do it. Stop calling
Surrender,
yourself a liar.
In other words.
In other words, you can't continue to call yourself a liar and hope to resolve anything. I mean, Bertrand Russell, who's a very, very important figure in this field, said you can't do anything with a paradox. There's no resolution to it. You can't at the same time say that you're a liar and tell the truth and vice versa. So his solution to the problem was he banished it. He said, don't do it. Stop. Because as long as you continue to regard yourself as a liar, you're never going to resolve the issue because it's unresolvable.
Right.
The only thing you can do with it is to dissolve it.
Oh.
You see what I'm saying?
The paradox can't
be resolved.
Yeah.
It can only be dissolved. So you can't.
Okay.
You have to stop doing that. Now, there's more there's more about it. I'll get into it a little later if we have time. But you can't do it. So it's called, in psychology, there's a phrase it's called cognitive dissonance.
I know that word.
Leon Festinger, the psychologist, he coined the phrase. And here's what, a cognitive dissonance means. I mean, it's really a state of unhappiness, but what he means is you're holding two ideas which are at odds with each other at the same time. It's like, for example, like if you're smoking a cigarette and at the same time you're afraid of getting lung cancer. I mean, well, you can't. That's called you have two ideas which are at loggerheads with each other, and so that is definitely defined as a state of unhappiness, obviously, right?
Wait a minute, Peter. Can I'm in a cognitive dissonance right now? Will you work me through it?
Sure.
Can we do it from that? Because I'm very much about sharing. I think, you know what I mean? If we can share this and you're clearly, you know what you're talking about, and it'll help me.
You're invited.
Oh, sweet. Okay, so cognitive dissonance. Dissonance?
Cognitive dissonance.
Oh, dissonance. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Which is, and you've already described it. It's basically where head and heart, are, the way I've always said it, are arguing. And
It's like arm wrestling with yourself and the belief that one arm can beat the other without the other one losing.
It's really
an impossible situation.
That's the nature of unhappiness. That's true. That's so funny here's my situation. George Kavassalis, who's I'm really into George Kavassalis. I'm watching his videos. I'm listening to his interviews. That's all wonderful. I bought my ticket. I reserved my hotel room. I'm going to see George Kavassalis August 27th and 28th. You know, yippee-yappy, good for Goldie.
Okay,
now we're here August 25th, and Hurricane Irene she's coming. I don't know where she's going to hit. I don't know what she's going to do. So now all of a sudden, I don't know what part of me, I believe it's my heart saying don't go, but my head is going, oh, come on, I want to go to the show. I want to go to hear George live and be with like-minded people.
That's a perfect example of cognitive dissonance.
Okay.
No. You want me to walk you through it?
Please. That would be outstanding.
Okay. Look, whenever you're faced with two alternatives, I mean, it seems like very, very businesslike, but we really do operate this way. We look at the cost-benefit analysis, right? We say, okay, we have reasons for doing it, and we have reasons for not doing it, right? That's who you are.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
Now, how do you make a decision?
Right.
Okay, fair enough. I guess what is called a tipping point. That's the phrase I use nowadays with that book.
What's
a tipping point?
Yeah.
How do you decide A as opposed to B, right? I mean, that's normally that's a conflict to begin with. All right. Now, you want to resolve this in a way where you're at peace with yourself, correct?
Correct.
That's what you want. Ultimately, whatever choice you make doesn't matter, as long as at the end of when you finish making your choice, you're going to be at peace with yourself. That's all we care about.
Right on.
Okay. Okay. Now watch how distrust bugs us. Watch how distrust does us in.
Okay.
So we're faced with it. Well, I mean, it's a very common thing. I mean, you have two alternatives. Should I go? Should I not go? Okay.
Right.
Now, if I were to say to you, okay, as long as you don't resent your choice afterwards, you have no problem.
Okay.
So let's say, for example, you don't go. And the reasons why you don't go is because of the weather, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Okay. Now, you're giving up talking to your George. I agree. But you say, well, wait, all things considered, I think I'd rather be safe as opposed to be enlightened for the moment.
Indeed.
Okay.
Of course.
Or you go the other way. It says, well, safety be damned. I want to be enlightened.
Well, see, because to be honest, I'm a rebel. I've been a rebel my whole life.
Right.
So I have often gone, and that's part of a paradox of living, too, literally going against certain, you know, going beyond safety. Because that's the juice of life. I have found, you know, tremendous things have happened when I've gone beyond the rules, quote unquote, of life.
So let's see how that plays out, Goldie. Okay.
Okay.
So let's say, all right. Here's what we're going to do. Okay, Goldie, you're going to go.
Okay.
Done deal. Now, would you be at peace with that decision?
Well, until I'm driving home in the hurricane and, you know, I'm flooded,
I'm
stuck.
It doesn't matter which choice you make, as long as you say, look, I mean, as long as you're prepared to accept the consequences of your choice, you don't have a problem. So if I say to you, suppose I was your Dutch uncle and I said, okay, listen, Goldie, here's the proposition. I think it's too dangerous, stay home. And you said, gee, thank you, Peter, I think that's good advice.
Right.
Now, as long as you don't play around with something called, oh, maybe I should have, I could have, you got no problem.
Right.
I'll put it to you another way. There's an emotion out there which is absolutely fraudulent. You know what the emotion is? Regret.
Regret is an absolutely
fraudulent emotion, because regret means, people usually say, well, I should have done this, I could have done that. It's all nonsense. Regret means you should have known what you didn't know.
Right.
And that's never the case, because, I mean, when you do something, you expect a certain outcome, and you can't predict with certainty what that outcome is going to be. Now, if you accept that as reality, then you never can be regretful, because you say you're not going to blame yourself because the outcome wasn't what you thought it was.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Oh, you're beautiful. No, and it's very clear. You're absolutely – because I spoke to my roommate. She was also extremely supportive of – she's coming in from Maine to go to Boston. But, of course, because she's more north, she's like, you know, I could maybe come in, but for me to come and then I'm going to have to probably drive back through the hurricane. I mean, in other words, there was no guilt from my roommate. She completely understood. She supported me. But the truth is, there's the me in this is going, I want what I want.
Yes, but you don't have to. But what you really want is not to have to apologize for whatever choice you make. So if you say, listen, I mean, this idea of driving a car in a hurricane is unappealing, that should be a sufficient explanation for you. Done deal, end of story. What more does one have to say? See, what you're doing is
clearly.
Here's where self-distrust comes into it. Then you start playing around. Wait a minute. No, you've made a choice. It's an either-or thing. I'm not going because I really don't relish the prospect of driving in a hurricane. Now, what more need be said about that?
No, nothing.
You notice?
But what if the hurricane doesn't hit? See, that's another thing
I'll tell you exactly.
Oh, we're going to get there, too? Okay, good.
No. Well, first of all, are you supposed to be prescient? Are you supposed to know in advance things are going to happen with certainty? You can't blame yourself for that, because, look, everything we do is a probability estimate. And so if the hurricane didn't turn out that way, well, then you made a probability estimate, but in this particular case, it didn't turn out. So are you supposed to know that in advance? Are you going to blame yourself for not knowing it?
No.
You see
but
what I'm saying?
Right, but I really have to come to a clarity. I mean, and your clarity is crystal. Boy, I mean, it's very I love it, because you're giving us the tools that when it's time to make the decision, you know, and with a clarity that I can't, you know, I surrender. I cannot argue, nor would I. And I'm telling you, Peter, I am the great debater.
I can see you do have talents along those lines.
I definitely have the gift of gab. Maybe now, are you Jewish? Is that what you were saying a few minutes ago? Did you say that you're Jewish?
No, I'm Italian.
I thought you were Italian, but I didn't know. Because I guess the Jews and the Italians, we get gifted with the gift of gab, right? I can debate.
I was brought up in the Bronx in New York, and I have for some reason, at least I try to analyze, Jews and Italians have always gone on very well with each other. I think it has something to do with love of food. I'm not sure altogether.
Yeah, no, indeed, and I agree. And because the truth is, in my household, we all had a voice. And we were all screaming at octaves that were just, you know, I've had friends come over and they can't handle the screaming. I'm like, you should not be here then, because this is the way we operate. And we're basically we're a New York Jewish family that relocated to Connecticut. I mean, that's the only difference. But anyways, back on topic, the truth is, right, what you're saying is, again, it goes back down to the core of, A, I couldn't, you know, trust yourself. There's, you know.
Yes.
The divinity is there as long as we trust it.
So I'll put it to you in this form. Look, whenever we're faced with a choice, what preoccupies us is this following question. Say, okay, look, well, first of all, let's deal with reality. Every choice we make is a probability estimate. I mean, we're usually quite good at it, you know, but we can't guarantee the outcome because, as I say, you cannot say with certainty that anything you plan on is going to come out the way you want. That's simply dealing with reality.
That has
nothing to do with our personality. It has to do with the nature of randomness in the universe.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? So, all right. So that, and as I say, we're quite good at it. We're very good at it. But we cannot claim that we can guarantee the outcome. You can't.
Right.
Because that's not the nature of reality. Okay.
Right.
Now, so once we understand that, this is a probability estimate. It'll probably be the way I expect it to be, and that's usually the case. However, if it doesn't turn out the way I expected, you have a choice at that point. You're going to do one of two things. You're either going to say there's something that proves that there's something about me that's bad at decision making, or you're going to say, no, wait a minute, I'm dealing with the real world, and to use a vernacular, shit happens.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So you have a choice. You're either going to say, well, wait a minute, I guessed, in this particular case, I guessed wrong. It has nothing to do with me, because we're always guessing, or you're going to use it as evidence that somehow you're a defective human being, which is what my original thesis is, right? Now, if you believe you're a defective human being, you're going to use that as evidence, but it's only evidence of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But if you know you're not a defective human being, then you'll say, well, why didn't it turn out? Because you'll say, in all honesty, shit happens. Things happen which we do not have final control over.
So it's brilliant. You're absolutely right. And you're not just right. There is a universal truth about what you're saying, because it's about being gentle with ourselves, and not just gentle, but really acknowledging that you can only be in the moment that you were in, having the information that you had.
Precisely.
And like these, you know,
if anybody has tried to attack you or accuse you, you could say with total authority, well, how come you did that? And you could say in all truth and honesty, oh, I guessed wrong. And that would be definitive.
Right.
There's nothing more to be said. Now, as I say, you go one or two ways. You're either going to use that as evidence that somehow you're bad at making decisions, which is what killed you. But that only becomes possible because you've already defined yourself as somebody who's defective. But if you didn't define yourself as defective, you're not going to use it as evidence of anything.
Right.
Accidents do happen, and it says nothing about you. It just defines the nature of reality, right? Which means we are not prescient. We cannot predict the future with certainty.
Right.
Now, that's either existential or reality, or it's a myth. It's reality. So what happens, if I do something and you do something and it doesn't turn out, now the old me and the old Goldie might have said, you see, I knew I was a screw-up. And no, right? No, but the enlightened Goldie and the enlightened Peterson, wait a minute. I cannot predict with certainty everything I do, and if it doesn't turn out the way I want it to turn out, all that tells me is it is a probability estimate that didn't turn out. There's no fault finding, there's no blaming, there's none of that. Did you notice? But if you define yourself normally, in quotation marks, as somebody who's defective in some peculiar way, you will extrapolate that in an entirely different way.
Absolutely.
So, for example, let's take a concrete example. Will you go to see George or will you not? Okay. I don't care. As long as whatever choice you make, you're not going to beat yourself up, the choice is fine.
Right. I'll be honest with you, after literally in the midst of this discussion, I'm not going to go. I mean, my heart is telling me,
Something? You always heard it's a cliche, but it's you trust your intuition. Intuition
yes.
is not some kind of wish fulfilling fantasy. It means
Indeed.
You're looking at your driving ability, you're looking at where you have to go, you're considering all the possibilities, and at the end of it, you're going to say, I think not. Trust that.
Right.
That's your intelligence.
Trust that. Trust, because I have often gone, not often, but in my earlier days, I basically tell people all the time, you can't preach, you know, follow your gut, follow your intuition, and then just because your intuition gives you an answer you don't want to hear, not follow it.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's like you got to trust that your intuition has, you know, your greatest good. In other words, I get that I can go to see this thing. But I have literally, like you said, I have visualized myself coming home.
Yes.
And I mean, it's extremely, it's easy for me to see extreme chaos.
Yes.
And I basically never see myself pulling into my driveway on this vision. I don't see myself making it home. That's not to say I'm going to die, but I see myself this trip turning into a long experience afterwards that... I just don't want to deal with that.
You see what I'm saying? You know how you drive. You know all kinds of things that you maybe not even be able to verbalize. And now,
okay.
based on what you know, how you drive at night, a whole bunch of things. So
yes.
intuition really is, you can define it one of two ways. It could be a sixth sense, that's one possibility, or it could be a quick accumulation of data which says, no, I don't think I want to do it because you know something.
Right.
So when
right.
And you see how it all comes back to trusting yourself.
Yes.
See, once you trust yourself, then these are not issues. So you can go either way. Yeah, and you can also say, well, I don't know. I mean, it's rather adventurous. I like to live on the edge. You can do that also.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
You can do whatever you want to do. The point is, as long as you don't regret an outcome, if it turns out not the way you want, you've got no
right.
problem.
Right.
I'll tell you a funny thing, you know. This is going
okay.
to sound so simple-minded, it may shock you. But you
no,
know,
no, I love simple, though. Simple
well,
is
I'm gonna
beautiful.
I'm going to give you something simple. All right, I'm going to wipe out a whole school of thinking about early developmental experiences here. If somebody says to you, why did you do that, usually in an accusatory way, right?
Okay.
This would be the definitive answer. Definitive. The answer would be, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
That statement is impeccable. That
yeah.
statement is absolutely impeccable. Because what people say, well, you should have known better, that's not even English. What do you mean you should have known better? If you knew better, if you knew something different, you would have done it. I mean,
right.
what I'm saying
you would have
is
done it differently. Yeah, no, so
no.
The
definitive answer, you never have to apologize for what you did. I mean, even, for example, when you had a history of this drug addiction, why
yeah.
did you do it? Well, you could say, given the fact that I was miserable, given the fact that I was unhappy, it seemed like the best solution at the time was for me to drug myself.
Peter, that's exactly what I have learned.
Yes.
Because I was drugged, I would have committed suicide, no lie, if I had
Correct.
To feel the pain until I was actually mature enough to handle and go through it in therapy with somebody. Until that point, the drugs, and I have said this, you know, this is my world. I don't recommend this for anybody else, but the drugs actually saved my life because it allowed me to go numb until I was ready to feel, and I came close to dying, but I didn't die.
You know,
so I came out.
And if somebody said to you, well, you should have known better, they're talking nonsense. The fact
Absolutely.
Of the matter, given your mindset, drugs at that time seemed like a good idea at the time.
Absolutely.
Then, you know, see what I'm saying? That if you trust yourself, no matter, even when you're unhappy and you're screwed up, you still do what you think you got to do. And so what
yes.
I'm driving at is that self-confidence, which is the opposite of self-distrust, is the nature of unhappiness. See, what we're talking
right.
about, unhappiness is always reducible to this one singular idea, that there's something about us that we can't trust, there's something about us that's not quite right. If you remove that from the equation, Goldie, think about that. That changes your whole emotional life. You know, you stop beating yourself up or saying, trying to justify. You don't have to justify a thing, you know. So if anybody says, well, why did you do that, Goldie? It seemed like a good idea at the time. That would have to shut them up.
Yeah.
Indeed,
you can't argue with it. And when you say impeccable, you don't know how much. Those are the kind of juicy words that Goldie loves.
Unassailable. Do you like that one?
What is it?
Unassailable, irrefutable. Do you like those? I'll give you a couple more.
Well, impeccable is the one that had the ding for me.
Oh, you like impeccable? Okay. All right.
Well, yeah, because it's integrity. Because I'll tell you why. Partially, I cleaned houses, right? 4 years I cleaned houses, and then I went into the nanny business. And I had a partner when we were cleaning houses, and I knew this intuitively. I was like, when we started, I go, listen, we are gonna be tested, I'm sure, with money, with all sorts of things, you know, to see, you know, because basically people are letting you into their homes when they're not there. So I was like, I said, here's the goal, and I would like to do this from the start, the inception of this business. I was like, not only will we never steal a dime, I mean, not a single penny from anything. I said, I also want to be that we don't snoop, because that's another big issue. And I said, now here's the reason why we're going to never do that, because the amount of references and all that we're going to get, because if we do it once, our way of thinking will allow us to do it hundreds of times. But if we never do it, there is a glow about us that when any customer comes to us and says, can you be trusted, not only is it our truth, we've never done it. We've never snooped. You know, because the truth is, I don't care if they've got diaries, dildos, or drugs in their nightstand. In other words, I don't need their life to fulfill my life anyways. I need them to pay me, and I need them to clean their house. That's all I needed to do. And this, I know, stems a lot from that whole idea of, you know, feeling worthy about myself, because I felt that, and my girlfriend Cindy, who was also impeccable, we just if there was a sock hanging out of a drawer, I'd open the drawer, tuck the sock in, push the drawer back in. I never snooped. Even when I date people, I don't go through their medicine cabinets or whatever, which I know a lot of people do in bathrooms. And so, but the key of what I'm saying is impeccable to me is about, I can honestly tell you without being afraid of, you know, getting hit by lightning, I've never snooped, even as a nanny, and I've been doing that for 20 years.
And you notice, what's wonderful about it, Goldie, is this. When you know, I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but if you talk about mental health, if you want to use that phrase, one's integrity is what produces that.
You're
a straight shooter, you're honest, you don't mislead, you don't cheat, you don't distort. Well, I mean, if you have any hope of being happy, you would have to admire those virtues, wouldn't you?
Well, indeed. My father, who in 1983 our house burned down to the ground and we rebuilt, he rebuilt with the builder with a very loose contract that essentially was a handshake. And he instilled in me, you should always be known to be, your word should be golden. He goes, because that will take you farther in life than even if you have a lot of money in the bank. He was like, because you'll need people to connect. So make sure your word is golden.
And if you look at it.
Now my name is. No. Sorry.
Well, no, but I'll tell you what's beautiful about it. Because look, first of all, the fact is, look, I've even taught my son to say, look, do what you say. Be a person that says, if he says it, then. I mean, there used to be, a handshake, you should be able to do it. Unfortunately, I think you become more cynical. But the fact of the matter is, a person of your word gives you an enormously, it feels good to be an honest human being. And as it turns out, there's a bonus. Contrary to the cynical world we live in, it's also good business.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And to be honest, I took that over in if I made promises to my kids, you know, that I was nannying for, come hell or high water, I kept those promises. I mean, because I see that in parenting a lot where they, okay, we'll do it tomorrow. And then the kids come back tomorrow and they're like, no, I don't feel. And I'm like, you know, I'll encourage the parent. Listen, you know, you're instilling this more in your child than you are in me, but you should really be keeping your word with your children so they know the power of keeping your word. So
you're the living example of it. And you're doing two things for them. You're giving him a kind of an inner integrity, which feels good, and it also happens to be very good public relations advice.
Yes.
Right. Yes. I mean, you say, well, you can't rely on her. Thanks a lot. You just shot yourself in the foot, right?
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So, this is a fabulous conversation.
Okay. Where do we leave off, Goldie? You tell me. I mean, I'm trying to think.
Okay, well, we basically...
But the decision about seeing George or not. Now, what I'm saying to you is, as long as you recognize that all choices are made in amidst an aura of probability, that if it doesn't turn out the way you want, nothing to fault yourself with. And the fact of the matter is, if you decide I don't feel comfortable traveling in a hurricane in a car, trust that. You know, it's an interesting thing. Sometimes people will ask you to do something, and then you'll get this strange feeling in your stomach sometimes, usually. And that feeling tells you something. Among other things, what it generally tells you is that I'm not comfortable with what I'm asked to do. And that doesn't come from stupidity. It comes from knowledge. You see, there's something about this that I'm not comfortable with. And usually what that means is I don't really believe I can pull it off.
Mm.
Trust that. That's called your intuition.
Yeah.
Right? If somebody says, drive in the hurricane, Goldie, you can do it, and you get that feeling in your stomach, guess what?
Yeah, you're right.
I can do it, but not successfully. I don't really feel comfortable with that, right? No, it's like, I'm a very accommodating person, you know, and when anybody asks me to do something, I generally help them out. And on rare occasions, I find myself getting in that feeling in my stomach. Now, Goldie, you be my shrink. Tell me, what am I thinking at that moment?
When you have the feeling in your stomach?
What am I thinking?
What you think? You're doubting, I would assume.
Again, I don't think I could pull this off. And so I'm being asked to do something that I'm not satisfied that I can pull off, and that's what that feeling tells me. That's not just a feeling in your gut. It's not a gut reaction. It's something I believe which manifests itself in my gut. See, whenever you're being asked to do something that you're not comfortable with, well, what does that tell you? Well, I don't know. You're asking me to do something which I have some reason to believe that I can't pull it off. And that's why you're uncomfortable. And what you're going to do is you're going to listen to that.
Yeah.
If
you trust yourself, you're going to listen to that, right?
Notice trusting yourself as opposed to distrusting. Back to my theme, right?
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? It always comes back to that. You'll find that every time you're unhappy, every time you're troubled, it'll always come. This sounds like an outrageously grandiose statement, but I assure you it's true. Every time you find yourself resisting or troubling yourself, there's something going, I'm telling you, it's the result of some kind of self-distrust. And I've never seen an exception. And I'm saying if we could remove that from the human equation, that self-distrust, I maintain you change everything. You see the world in an entirely different way.
Well, not just seeing the world, you would actually experience the world in an entirely, you know, in other words, if we just trusted, in other words, if the doubt is there, well, don't respond to the doubt, respond to the, in other words, let the action follow the trust. Whatever the response is, even if it's an answer like for me, I want to go see George. I paid for my ticket, you know, clearly there's a financial loss here.
But you don't
want to
drive in a hurricane.
But I'm smart enough to know that there's a priority here that says, I mean, because truly, right, I mean, and I'm telling you, that have you ever heard, I don't know if you ever, the Celestine Prophecy just came out with their last book.
I never read it, but I heard of the book, yeah.
Yeah, the last, I think it's the 12th Insider, something like that, and one of the things they, and I was just reading the book, he basically talks about if you can visualize something in your mind easily, that's a good sign. If you have difficulty, you know, visualizing something, honor that. Know that there is a... And in other words, I can't visualize myself getting into the driveway coming home. I keep stopping, and it's like, don't ignore that because, you know, the wise person uses all of their physical sensations.
He's saying the same thing I'm saying, only in different words.
Yeah, no, indeed.
You can visualize yourself not doing it. Trust that.
Yes.
Trust that.
Yes.
By all means, trust that. absolutely the case, right?
Yeah.
So when
yeah.
you notice, for example, now think about this. Now, this is I know this is a rather radical concept, quite radical. But look, if you grafted that onto your soul, you say, okay, now Goldie says, you know, from now on in, I'm not going to give myself a hard time. I'm not going to try to second-guess myself. When I look at a situation, I'll do what I do consciously or unconsciously, and then once I make a choice, that's the end of it. There's nothing more to talk about. I mean, that's really how some people live. Now, I mean, not everybody who's wise knows me. I mean, some people figured it out themselves, because I've heard people say things like that. I've heard people say, well, you know, he says, look, once I make a decision, I never look back. Well, apparently they know something.
Right. Right.
You know, they can't explain it to themselves the way I can explain it. But, yeah, they know something. I mean, you make your choice, done deal. That's it. You know, I mean, I remember one time when D-Day happened, when General Eisenhower, meanwhile, you got a couple of 100,000 men on the ships ready to go. You've got the worst storm brewing in 40 years in the English Channel. And they say, okay, Ike, what do we do? One man.
Right.
Do we go or we do not go?
Yeah.
I mean, what do you do with that? What is he doing? He's guessing. He's saying he figured out, he thought the pros and the cons, said, okay, we go. And, of course, could have been the worst mistake in the world. But undoubtedly what he would have done, what a lot of people do, you see, he would have started kicking himself and beating himself. And I would have said to Ike, it was a probability estimate. You did the best you could. Nobody can do more than that. But he wouldn't have done that. The typical impulse is to beat themselves up.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we do, right? So you make a decision, I make a decision. Like I was talking to one of my clients the other day. She has to go for surgery, you know, and she's speculating about all kinds of disastrous outcomes. I said, look, you're going for that surgery because you have decided it is in your interest to do so. You are probably right. It will probably turn out. And if it doesn't turn out, are you going to beat yourself up and say, I should have known? She said, no. You see the point I'm leading to?
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
You know, so you notice how it always comes back, Goldie, to this question of self-trust. I'm telling you, this is the demon. This is our nemesis. So if you can understand that, and not only that, and I'm going one step further, I'm trying to tell you that this belief that we can't be if you believe you suspect you're a liar, you can never resolve your problem because you can never be too sure whether you're telling the truth or not.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, obviously, as a core belief, we have to know we can be trusted, at least for our own experiences. I mean,
yes. Absolutely. So when I'm saying, well, beyond that, you are the supreme expert on who you are. I mean, I noticed the theme of your program is to find out who you are.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Now think about it. Well, the reason why we don't know who we are is because most people normally and typically suspect that we can't be trusted. But if you believe that you could be trusted, then you would instantly know who you are. The whole quest for identity only comes about because you believe there's something about you that's not trustworthy, that you can't trust yourself. But if you remove that from the equation, wouldn't you know who you are?
Of course.
You see what I'm saying? So every theory of human nature that I've ever studied, and I think I've studied pretty much all of them, all start they all start with the idea, Will Goldie, that somehow human beings are tainted. Whether you talk about I mean, I've read them all, and they say, whether you say you can't be trusted, Plato says our intellect is imperfect. Religions say we are concupiscent, which is to say we have a natural inclination to evil, and we go on and on and on and on. No matter who you read, Freud, Marx, whoever. And they all start off with a theory of human nature that says there's something about us that's screwed up. And then they proceed to develop a system based on that premise. Now, if what I'm saying is correct, that we're not screwed up, because let's face it, a system of thought is only as valuable as the premise upon which it rests. If the premise is false, then the whole system falls apart.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's so funny because this whole idea, you know, again, this is all about mind control. I mean, what you have just, and like I said, I know, I mean, my show goes into that whole thing. But what I love is, see, my instinct when I read your book, was, I mean, exactly what you first said when you first came on, I'm being gagged, no lie, gagged to death by the New Age movement of love and light. And it's not that, I am not a component of forgiveness, and I'm not a component of compassion. Believe me, you don't go from being where I was, you know, in fear and in pain and in shame and in guilt, to being who I am now without experiencing those.
Yes.
But what I don't like at this point, I mean, literally ad nauseum, is nobody's talking about the components that you have to acknowledge in the dark to at least set yourself on the journey. In other words, I had to acknowledge I was a person, like the very first line, literally the first day I ever sat down with a therapist when I turned 30 and I went to the therapy was, I'm a smart woman making stupid choices. Help me know why.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew that, because I'm like, I've got brains. I know what the hell I'm doing, and yet my life is completely a mess. Why? Why is that? You know, but in other words, you have to acknowledge the dark aspects, which is what, you're so much more impactful. Forget the idea that you're not coming from a galactic space, and you're not coming from crystals, and you're coming from just a really grounded perception of how to change who we are, that I know in my heart is extremely palpable for what is going to be coming up in the next 18 months. You're beautiful, Peter. I'm so glad you're on the show. You're beautiful.
Thank you so much. I'm flattered.
My pleasure. Yeah, no, I mean that too, because, see, I trust my instincts, because I can tell you people that I know that just because you were talking about, you know, explaining unhappiness,
mm-hmm.
they wouldn't touch you with a 10-foot pole. Because of that, where I was like, okay, here's somebody that really gets that, you know, if we keep just focusing on the light, what it really comes down to is a fear to go where what got us in the dark. Because I tell people, listen, when you first wake up, you're going to wake up and you're going to be knee-deep in shit. Because you know what wakes you up? The pain of where you are. That's
and
what gives you the
you
awakening.
Are, who you mistakenly believe you are.
Who you mistakenly believe you are, even better said. Exactly.
Okay.
So if that's where you are, then you got to at least acknowledge that. This is Eckhart Tolle's acceptance first, then it'll shift. If you don't own it, you can't shift it.
Yep.
So
yeah, well,
right on.
So we are in agreement then, self-acceptance. Now,
very much.
So that's what the name of the game is. With anybody who's self-accepting, you have now changed your life. You've metamorphosed your life. You've changed your life
yeah.
in the most radical of possibilities. Because let's face it, unless you understand that, all these various measures and prescriptions are antidotes. But if you didn't ingest the poison in the first place, there's no need to give an antidote.
Right.
See what I'm saying? Like, so the
right.
idea is, all right, look, is it really true? I'm going to tell you, I'll give you a line by Freud, which is a great line. You don't have to be a Freudian, but he was an observational genius. And I quoted my book. There's a great line by him. Here's what he says. He says, our greatest obstacles to psychotherapy is the need for self-punishment.
Hmm.
Think about that. Did he have that right? What he's saying in different words is, the fact that people need to believe that there's something wrong with them is what the problem is. There's nothing more powerful to overcome. Because everybody who will ever come for therapy, I assure you, is punishing themselves.
Yeah.
Right? I mean.
Yeah,
now watch how I'm going to analyze this, and you tell me if it fits. Look.
Okay.
You say, okay, now everybody who comes to therapy, everybody who reads a self-help book is unhappy. And we can say what unhappiness is comes from the need for somebody to punish themselves. I think that would be accurate.
I agree with that.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you very strange questions. Have you ever thought about the function of punishment?
Well, actually I have, because of the nannying.
Yeah, what's the purpose of punishment?
The purpose would be to guide...
To teach them.
Into the direction you want
exactly.
something to take place.
So when you punish yourself, what you're trying to do is you're trying to teach yourself to change something about yourself,
oh,
right?
Get out. Oh, that's hot. Okay. Right.
Well,
good.
Is that what it is? I mean, is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah.
That's the function of punishment. Punishment exists for that reason. Okay. Now, here's what the... Now we're going to give you a little more about paradox, okay?
Oh, I love it. Okay.
Okay. Now... So let's use the archetypal example. Okay, now, to say the slave owner and the slave.
Okay.
Now, the slave owner punishes the slave. He makes, in effect, he makes him feel bad, makes the slave feel bad, in order for him to do what the slave owner wants.
Okay.
Right? Now, the slave complies, and it's rational, because he figures if I don't comply, he may hurt me more, or he may kill me. And there's always a possibility, for example, of escape. So it's a very rational choice, if you think about it.
Okay,
now, but when the punisher and the punished are the same person, you just wrap yourself in a paradox. You're completely nuts at that point, because if you believe you have to punish yourself to become good, right?
Oh, wow.
Right?
Okay.
Now I'm going to punish myself to be a good person. But if I were to say to you, but why do you believe you're a bad person? You say, well, no, I can't believe that because I won't become good. So in order to be, this is going to be very complicated, but bear with me. I thought it through.
No, please, please.
Okay, so if you punish yourself, but you can't ever become good, because if you believe you're good, you'll never become better. And so punishment, self-punishment, stays with you the rest of your life. See, in other words, if you continue to punish yourself in order to become a good person, you're never going to become a good person. Because if you believed you were good, you'd really be bad, because you're not going to become a better person. As soon as self-punishment or punishment is tied in with becoming good, that's how you're going to live your life. So the only solution is, wait a minute, you're not bad. There's no need to punish yourself.
Right.
Really? Really?
Right.
You see? Now, you see, you have the paradoxical nature. Because as long as being good is associated with believing you're bad or punishing yourself, you're never going to feel good. So what's the solution to the paradox? To use my, hey, why do you believe? Look, if you were to ask somebody this question, I promise you, you're not going to know. But as soon as I tell you, say, oh my God, of course it has to be. If you were to ask somebody, why do you believe you're bad? What's the answer to that question?
Because I've been told them that.
No, I'm going to tell you in a minute. You're going to look at me and say, my God, this makes sense. Why does a person believe that they're bad? You know what it is?
Well, I mean, I know what I think
it is. And then
you
say, oh, my God, of course.
Go ahead.
The reason why people believe they're bad is in order to become good.
Oh, wow.
Well, think about it, right? Why do you punish yourself? Because you're trying to teach yourself to become a better person.
Right.
Right? So that's why we believe.
Wow, that's pretty hard, too.
Right? So why do people believe?
Yeah.
I've asked that question of a lot of people, and none of them have ever come up with the right answer. So don't be disappointed. But when you tell them, oh, my God, it has to be the case.
Well, because you know what's very interesting that I'm going to tell you from my own observation of being with the kids for 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that the kids today literally don't have that belief. There is no punishing these kids. I mean, there is no, and it's so interesting to watch how the parents and caretakers and teachers, how we have to work in the dynamic, because, in other words, where punishment for me was often, you know, you would spank me, you could humiliate me, you know, there were certain things that would basically get my goat, whether in fear or you know, not usually in some sort of fear.
Mm-hmm.
The punishment would work. The kids today, and not for me, I don't punish, you know, I shouldn't say I don't punish. The way I would punish is usually taking away something they enjoy. I mean, never, you don't hit, obviously, I'm a nanny, but I would never hit anyways, but I'm like, okay, I'm not going to impose something bad, but I'm going to let you know, okay, you don't get something good, if, you know, that's the way it is.
And, that makes sense, but here's what the problem is, you see. You don't have to punish them because they punish themselves, and I'll tell you how they do that. Look, think of any teenager. Virtually every teenager on the planet believes they're not intelligent enough, they're not sociable enough, they're not skinny enough, they're not athletic enough, they're not whatever.
Right.
You know,
right.
All these kids, one way or the other, decide that there's something about them that are lacking. And so they either apologize for the fact they're too fat or too skinny or not intelligent enough, not athletic enough, not popular enough, and it never stops. Now, nobody's formally taught that, but what do you think these kids are doing to themselves? You don't think these kids punish themselves. Of course, they're not aware of it. That's why a guy like me has to enter the picture. They punish themselves because they think that's what they have to do to improve themselves. As it turns out, they forget the second part, and all they're stuck with is being punishing themselves. I mean, think about this, like bulimia or anorexia, that sort of a thing. Where do you think that comes from? It comes from self-contempt.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, these are kids that literally starve themselves, the whole distortion of what a body should look like is completely fanciful. But you see what I'm driving at? So that as soon as you start believing, look, I'm quite sure when you were a kid, you did the same thing I did. I mean, we all did the same thing in varying degrees, that you were not pretty enough, you were not thin enough,
oh,
you were not intelligent
absolutely.
Enough. I mean, who doesn't
absolutely.
Put themselves through that? So that's what you notice, but it all comes down to my central idea, which is self-doubt. That's what they do to themselves. The specifics don't matter, but the psychology of I doubt the desirability of who I am is the source of all our misery. Anybody who stopped doing that, there's nothing to guess about this. Watch what they do. Watch what they feel. Now, you've seen people maybe on very, very rare occasions where you see people, there's a certain charisma about them. There's a certain kind of peacefulness about them. You can infer what they're thinking. You know what they're thinking. They are at peace with themselves. You see it in their eyes. You see it in their face. Now, these people are rather relatively rare. But when you see them, they're unmistakable.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So then why...
Go ahead.
So why can't we be the same? We want to go through life.
I was just about to say, I aspire to be that.
That is
my aspiration.
Indeed.
Yes.
Indeed. And my ambition is to expedite the process.
Right on.
You there yet?
Well
Golden,
done
you better
to both
get
of
there.
Us.
Otherwise, I would get angry at you.
I love it. No, brilliant. I mean, absolutely. I'll be honest with you, George Cavassos. He. There is a piece about him. I mean, there is
you
a
see,
piece.
Can't you sense it? Sometimes you see the list of, like, for example, you'll see clerics, you know, like, for example, rabbis or priests or whatever. And, you know, a lot of them are struggling like anybody else. But every once in a while, you'll see, for example, a religious person, and you look at their face, you say, no, they're someplace else.
Yeah.
You could just look at their face and you say, no.
Yeah, it's a field. When you're in their presence, you feel present.
You can feel it. And what you're feeling is
the
person, I think it's palpable. You can actually, you just feel they're at peace with themselves.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Know? And it's a glorious thing. And we love to be around such people.
Absolutely.
Because I think it gives us, you mean you can achieve that? That's achievable? I remember many years ago, there was a woman outside of the Pathmark that I used to shop at. And she was one of those girls that would you know, ring a bell and collect money for the Salvation Army.
Okay.
And I used to look at her face. And I just couldn't take my eyes off her. She was exquisite. And I remembered I should go back for a couple of contributions with her. I want to look at it some more, you know. I come back, put some more money in the little pot, you know. And I would just look at her. And you could see that she was transcendent, that somehow, somewhere, she was in this world, but not quite of it.
Right. On.
And during the years, I've seen people like that. Like there was a priest I also know. He was on. As a matter of fact, he's on television. Quite a bit. He's also a psychologist, a remarkable man. And one time I happened to see him in the street, because I used to watch him. I said, I really like this guy a lot. And one time I saw him in the street. I had an office in Manhattan a number of years ago. And he happened to pass by. And I went up to him, and I wanted to look at him. And I grabbed him his hand, and I said, I see you on television. And he took my hand in his, and he looked in my face, and I said, ah, he is the real stuff.
Wow.
You know what I mean? There are people like that. They're just you can see the peacefulness of them, you know? And I'm saying that person can never, in order for them to be peaceful, somewhere, somehow, you know they've let go of all the baggage. This question, there's something about them they have to apologize for. And there's no arrogance there. I mean, there's no arrogance looking like that.
Agreed.
No, because arrogance would be the opposite, because arrogance would be a compensatory behavior that's designed to make, you know, to compensate for what you think is wrong with you. No, just peacefulness. Gentleness, kindness, that sort of thing. And when we see people like that, we're stunned by it because they become a living example of what self-acceptance could be.
Absolutely.
See? So I'm saying, okay, so Goldie, so here's the deal, Goldie. Okay, there's nothing wrong with you, Goldie. There's absolutely nothing you have to apologize for. I'm saying this with absolute honesty and truth. Now, as I say this to you, you know, I'm trying to seduce you. You do realize that. I'm luring you to where you really want. A seducer is a person who says, I know you may be kicking and fighting, but I know what you really want, and I'm going to take you there. And so it's
take
a very I'm seducing you right now. I'm going to seduce you, Goldie.
Okay.
Now, so now I say, oh, but you notice something. See, now, what you could do is you say, you know, you got it right, and I'm being seduced. Correct. However, when you do say that, there's something in us that seems to, we're not quite comfortable with it. It's almost like alien in a peculiar way. So it takes a little time to assimilate this idea.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like really,
yes.
Nothing, you know, nothing is wrong with because in the end, look, I can give you a definition of the what is the opposite of happiness, of unhappiness, Sally. You know what it is? I'll give you a strange dichotomy.
It's not happiness, is it?
Self-confidence.
There you go. Right
on. A self-confident person does not need me or people like me or books.
Yeah.
A self-confident person answers virtually all questions.
Yeah.
They don't second guess themselves. They don't trip. They would know automatically all the things I'm telling you. I don't know how they arrived at it. You know what I mean? Sometimes people just stumble on. They figure it out. They dope it out. I don't know. Because I'd like to think that everybody who's at peace has talked to me, but that's not the case.
but you're one avenue. So listen, I'm grateful you're out there because you've been at this for 30 years, so that's beautiful. You know what I'm, so you've talked to many people.
30 years, I deal with a lot of people. But when I'm driving in, I say, okay, I mean, wow, what a concept. I mean, really, be at peace. You want to hear a great line, a tremendous line by one of the greatest minds and saints of all time. And I'm going to secularize it for you.
Okay.
You see this outside churches sometimes, and even philosophers talk about it. Here's a line by Augustine, St. Augustine. Here's the line. Love God and do as you please.
Right on.
Now if I were to secularize that, so you know, take it out of the question. When you see, if you look at loving God, what does that mean? It means that if you truly love God, put it in a secular context, if you're truly at peace, you never have to second guess what you're going to do, because what you please will always be consistent with loving God. So that once you're at peace with yourself, you never have to. Your behavior can only be consistent with that state of mind. You wouldn't even be. It would be impossible for you even to want to demean another human being. You would never even have such an impulse.
That's absolute truth.
Right.
That's absolute truth.
If you see love God, do as you please. If love God is a religious pronouncement or is an allegorical account of goodness, it doesn't matter. The psychological net result is the same. Do as you please, but a person with that mindset, what they please would always be consistent with that mindset. And so how in the world could you ever treat anybody miserably? It would be impossible.
Well, you know what I'd like you to do, because I really enjoy the way you unfold this, because, you know, I'm wondering if, I don't know if you've dealt with this before, because, like, when I first went to therapy, you know, my pendulum, so to speak, was definitely way over to the left, and I was, you know, I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy, all of those issues.
Sure.
I've been through several years and self-help books and, you know, The Awakening. I actually, what I'm finding now is the pendulum swung, and now arrogance, because I am a very confident person, in myself only, and it really is, I'm like, I'm responsible for my choices, I'll take responsibility, but if you can just discuss some of, you know, the nature of how, you know, how do you stay out of the arrogance, because that becomes easier to slip into, and once you get arrogant, then you lose that humbleness and that softness.
Yes, that's an excellent question, and I'll give you an answer.
Okay, great.
Okay, no, that's an excellent question. No, first of all, I'll back into it this way. The instigating question for my book, to me, the archetypal psychotherapeutic question is as follows. What are you afraid would happen if you were not unhappy? Or an alternative way of saying, what are you afraid would happen if you didn't believe there was something wrong with you? Okay? And you know what the answer you always get?
What?
If you believe with totality that you are, there's nothing about you that needs to be remedied or apologized, what do you think the average person would say in response to that? They're afraid they would become arrogant. They're afraid, in other words, to feel good is to end up feeling bad. If you believe, most people associate, for example, a person who believes they're good with arrogance.
Now, think about that. It's exactly not the case, because an arrogant person is a person who's posturing, who's strutting. In effect, it's compensatory behavior designed to overcome or to compensate for what you think you lack. To be a person without pride, a person who's peaceful himself, can never be arrogant, because an arrogant person doesn't believe that about themselves. Like, when you see somebody strutting or posturing, do you really believe they're at peace with themselves?
No, actually, I have seen how that actually turns. Like, I watch a lot of reality TV, and you know, they all claim, you know, they're beautiful, they've got money, blah 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 blah.
And you don't believe a word of it, right?
Well, because when you see behind the scenes, they're backstabbing, they're talking
exactly.
about each other's back. They're doing everything they can to demean the other, which of course is the projection coming from themselves. And I get that. You know,
so
you see in others what's really.
And you're quite
themselves.
Right. And you're quite right. So Goldie, here's what happens. So when you see people like that, you know, look, you can spot it all the time. I mean, I'm not just kind of defending these people, but well, you know, like when somebody struts, when somebody acts arrogantly, I mean, that is precisely the opposite of self-acceptance, because anybody who was at peace with themselves, they couldn't possibly engage in that kind of behavior. I repeat, it's compensatory behavior. They're trying to compensate for what they think they lack. Like, we see people show off in more outrageous ways. What do you think they're doing? That this priest I told you about, or this woman I told you that was outside Pathmark, there's no arrogance there. There's complete and total peace of mind and self-acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and most people in very, this may be a very subtle statement, but most people in very somewhat subtle ways, you can always spot that charisma I'm talking about. You don't see that very often, because most people are tooting their horn in some degree.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
You've seen that, right? I mean, they say, okay, I mean, they got something to prove. I mean, listen, see, anytime people have something to prove, already they've defined themselves. They're saying, I lack something, and now I have something to prove. I mean, think about how much human behavior is tied into status.
Oh, my God.
So what does that tell
yes.
you? These
yeah,
are people
especially in America.
With themselves? No, they got a lot to prove, you know. Now, I'm not even denying the desirability of beautiful things, a beautiful home, a beautiful car. I'm not advocating some sort of updated asceticism or denial of the flesh. No,
I'm not getting that from you. You're right. I'm not getting that from you at all. So.
Yeah, I mean, the pleasures, the things of this world should be enjoyed by all means.
Indeed.
Enjoy it.
Agreed.
Have a good time. But they have nothing to do with your peace of mind, nothing to do with self-acceptance, nothing to do for your happiness.
Yeah, agreed.
You see what
agreed.
I'm saying? That's why you read these books, and they keep on, they tell you about groups of people, married people more likely to be happy people. I mean, it's just useless information, because all these things, as desirable as they may be, tells you nothing, because your head is portable. No matter where you go, you carry that belief about yourself in your head. The environment is not going to change it.
Yeah.
Right? That's why you see people
who
have the world by the proverbial tail. And why are they imbibing drugs? I mean, people who are handsome or beautiful or rich or famous.
Oh,
or
right, right. Oh, no, because
talented.
They're miserable. They're empty inside.
Exactly.
I mean,
which means all the things that are supposed to make us happy. And I'm not denying the value of these. I got nothing against a French chateau. I got nothing against a beautiful car. No, by all means, they're beautiful.
No, I
somebody
agree.
Has to own them. But that's not going to make the difference.
Right.
You know, and so we have this kind of materialistic prejudice that somehow the more we acquire, or if we can change the conditions of our life and we can change it and acquire more things, that's going to make us happy. That's why these books who do surveys, they've missed the point entirely. I mean, how does it help you to know, gee, married people are more likely to be happy? What the hell does that tell you?
Well, right. It almost feels like a controlling agent that, you know, now you've got to find find somebody. And I was caught up in that, I'll be honest with you, for many years. It was
no
about,
doubt. Most of us are. Yeah, I am.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm 46 and never married. I mean, I struggled that, you know, perhaps I should just, you know, take the first one that comes along, because I've had proposals.
As a matter of fact, you know what we'll do, Goldie? If you invite me back, I'll give you a whole program about relationships.
I will absolutely invite you. Oh, yes, we will.
Oh,
yes.
I got a
Peter,
dynamite
you're definitely
stuff to
coming
tell you
back.
About.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
I'm going to tell you some stuff that's going to knock your socks off.
Excellent. I will absolutely have you back on several occasions. I enjoy your company very much.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Look, the idea of having a relationship, I don't want to get into that now.
We'll stay with the trust. Trust is a good, I'll have you back. We'll talk about the trust right now, because I'm getting hits on Facebook. People are resonating with what we're saying. The acceptance.
Oh, good.
Yes, good. Yes.
Well, you tell me when to end it, Goldie, and we'll do that. Do you want to end it now? It's okay.
No. We still got 26 minutes left.
Oh, okay, fine. Okay.
You mean end the show or end the topic?
No. I thought somehow maybe you had to answer these people right now and somehow
No, these are just girlfriends of mine going, they're resonating with what we're talking about.
Okay,
Janine,
good.
If you feel like it, call in. I mean, in fact, I can open it up. I mean, if anybody wants to call in and ask Peter a direct question or
By all means, I'm perfectly open to that.
646-929-2084, uh-huh. If you feel inclined, and definitely share with us and or whatever. I mean, but this is really good stuff, Peter, because, like, one of the things I've noticed recently is, and this is kind of bizarre, too, but I tend to attract people into my life that are the, I'll up you what, like, if I say something, they got to top that. That's it. Top that people.
Yes. Can you top this, they play?
If I say something, then they've done something bigger, better, or brighter. If I bought something new, they bought it even bigger and brighter. You know, it's like...
I wonder if I saw some comedy routines about that. You know, where, for example, like you say, well, when I was a kid, we didn't have anything to eat. And then somebody would say, yes, well, when I was a kid, we had to scrape the floor to eat the linoleum. You know, that kind of crazy.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly. Whether it's in suffering or in success, it's...
Monty Python did an outrageous thing about that, about fathers, what they went through when they were, you know, sometimes when I was a kid, that sort of routine. They did a whole comedy routine about that. Okay. But they say, can you top this? And that's a form of can you top this? He's like, you had a miserable life.
Exactly.
I got
exactly.
Something more miserable. Okay. So what's the question you're asking, Goldie?
Well, I guess part of it is because now, and here's how, you know, I love talking to you because I'm gaining insights. Now, I'll be honest with you. There's a presence in me that I know when to top this conversation has begun. And, you know, there are parts of me that, you know, in all honesty, want to say, you know, listen, you know, shut the F up. You know, can you just listen to my experience without having to share? But, and then what I'll do is, and I'll stop. I'll listen to them. But then I'll find that, you know, I'll hang up the phone and go, I don't want to talk to them anymore. You know, so I'm wondering, you know, maybe there's a – I think it's important. I know myself to be a catalyst.
Your instincts are quite right, Goldie. You don't want
to
talk to
not say anything?
I'll tell you why. Look.
Please. Okay.
So let's talk about communication. I think I can tell you a lot about that.
Look. Excellent. Okay.
Okay. When you talk – like, let's take you and I as an example right now. Now, why is this conversation going well? What ingredients are in this conversation that allow you and I to have a very pleasant conversation? Well, I can say that probably in any number of ways, but what's going on here is I respect you, you respect me.
Absolutely.
I'm on your side, you're on my side. We both want to produce a good show, and we don't see each other as adversaries.
Absolutely.
That's what makes it possible for you and me to have a pleasant talk with each other. And for example, I spotted that the first 5 minutes. I said, oh, we're going to have a – but, I mean, any professional, any person who's a host of a show would have to have that as a skill, it would seem to me. But okay.
Yeah.
Now, this
yeah.
person you're talking about, the reason why that's happening is because that other person has something to prove.
Mm.
And so they're in direct competition with you because they say, okay, I can meet that plane. Can you top this? And they're not really interested all that much in learning anything. What they're interested in is to proving to you that they are smart, proving to you that they know better than you. Now, there's nothing you can say that could be informative to them because they're not interested in that. Because what they're interested in is dominating the conversation and making themselves look good or proving to you, maybe to the world, you know, that they're a good debater, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you can spot that after about 3 or 4 minutes. I'll give you an example. Like if I talk to somebody... I've come across something like that. If I talk to somebody and after 3 or 4 minutes I find myself saying, no, I didn't mean that. If I say that more than 2 or 3 times, I already know I'm being set up.
Okay.
If I speak English, I know what I'm talking about, and how is it possible that they're misinterpreting what I say? It's not because I mumble. It's not because I don't know what I'm talking about. It has to be they have an agenda. And as soon as that happens, Goldie, what do I know? This is not a person I want to have a conversation with. So that person that you're talking about, there's not. If you said to that person exactly what I just told you, it would have no effect. If you said, listen, you know, you're playing Can You Top This? You're using me as a competitor, and somehow we're not enjoying this conversation because every time I say something, you seem to need to top it. Now, if you said that to them in all honesty, in all probability, they would reject it out of hand.
Yeah.
They wouldn't even listen to you. So
yeah.
you're not going to give them that little speech. What you're going to do, in effect, is shun them.
Oh, my. So religious.
There's a great line. It's an Arab line. It goes like this. There are those who do not know and know that they do not know. Teach them. And then there's another line which says, there are those who do not know and do not know that they do not know. Shun them.
Right.
He's of the latter category.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't know, and he doesn't know that he does not know. So you can't teach him anything. So, you know, you can always tell that. You know, see, when you're having a conversation and you find yourself struggling, see what I mean, that feeling in your stomach again?
Yes.
What do you, you know something is amiss. There's something going on here that's not quite right. Now, you notice when you and I are speaking, you never got that feeling. I never got that feeling.
Not at all. I'm elated. Yeah.
But, and I am elated, too. We're both enjoying each other's company. So you notice that the fact that we know that there's no hidden agenda here. I don't have a hidden agenda, and you don't have a hidden agenda. And the proof of it is I have no knot in my stomach, and you have no knot in your stomach.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It makes total sense. And the truth is, because, you know, to be honest, what I'm finding as life is getting more and more compressed, you know, time is compressing and space is compressing and life is compressing, there are less and less people I want in my inner circle. I mean, I just have less patience for, you know, because I had a gentleman that I had on my show a couple of times. I went hiking with him, and this is kind of a funny story. And he was a channeler. He would channel what I call all the big guns. He would channel Jesus, Mary Magdalene, Metatron, what I call really, you know, big ascended master beings. You know, he does not just channeling, you know, Tom the Mouse or something a little more down to earth. And, well, we kept having conflict. I mean, he was on my show, and because he's a vegetarian and a raw foodist, and I'm not. So I kept saying, listen, share your wisdom, but you got to say it from first person, because I know my listeners. I know my listeners eat meat, even perhaps like me, so occasional McDonald's. I mean, because I don't believe food necessarily is the decision maker of whether we are going to ascend into other dimensions. We already are in other dimensions. It's a matter of an awareness, blah, 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 blah. So I go hiking with this gentleman, bring him to a very sacred place. In fact, it's the place that I received the name Golden Hawk. Believe it or not, I wasn't born with that.
No, you told me that.
And you know, he's like, I had invited him to do a healing, and in all honesty, we get there. My entire gut is telling me, do not receive a healing from this gentleman. So we were kind of just sitting around. There was three other people that knew him well, that know me okay. And, you know, the truth is, I was like, I'm not going to do this. And he was like, you are being disrespectful to me. And, I mean, he went into this whole, I am Metatron, and you have disrespected me. Peter, it was like, it was a very interesting scenario, because my first thought was, now, I'm a catalyst. I have triggered people my entire life, many of them men, and stood literally face to face with these people. And this is how I know I have a presence with me. No one's ever hit me. I have one exception, but the majority of people that I trigger don't go into that space. But I clearly got, okay, you know, I need to remove myself from the situation, because the humility for me was simply, there was one girl there who had just dealt with a boyfriend who committed suicide. She had the marks on her arm from cutting herself, and she was like, I would like to receive a healing from this gentleman. And I was like, okay, you know what, let me gather my stuff. These are my woods. I'm going to go be in the woods by myself. You guys, you know, find your way out, whatever. I'll leave. I mean, and the funny part about it was, as soon as I was 30 feet out of this gentleman's presence, I literally got into the meditative state he so desperately wanted me to get into in his presence, And yet, when I was there, everything in my body was like, no, no, I can't do this with him here. And the reason why I'm saying this is essentially that I didn't know that when I first invited him, even though I should have known it, because I shouldn't. Because on the radio we had issues, you know, where he was like, "You got to be vegan and you got to be raw," and I'm like, "No, you don't. I've been on a spaceship and I eat McDonald's hamburgers. Don't tell me you have to." You know, like you were saying, this is one way to do it. There are many paths to everything that we speak about because there's 7 billion of us. You know, Clearly, if you know, there's going to be people in China that have never heard of you or me or this gentleman that are still going to get to where they have to go, even though they're on the other side of the planet. So that arrogance is something that
Yeah, exactly. You know what that exemplifies now? Look, let's see. I'm giving you the tools. Let's see. Look.
Okay.
The fact that he got angry at you, read his mind. What was he saying about himself?
He was
bad about himself because he thought you weren't listening to me. He thought you were dismissing him. So already we know he's got a problem.
Agreed.
And also, when people are insistent, what does that say about you? Look, first of all, that's pretty clumsy and unsophisticated. When you insist that people do what they don't want to do, you've actually done something very, very dumb, because what you've not done is say, well, first of all, instead of trying, I mean, even a good salesman knows that when somebody's resisting, being persuaded, that they try to find out what the reason is.
Right.
This guy leapfrogged over that and just said, you got to do it. I mean, this is pretty clumsy public relations, isn't it?
Well, and one of the first things out of his mouth was, since day one, you've intimidated me. I mean, he said that, and I went, I'm not trying to, I'm just being me.
Exactly. So
so that was the competing factor.
Yeah,
he
was competing with you somehow. Yeah, he intimidated
absolutely.
Me, so no, I have to dominate you. Okay.
Exactly.
If he weren't intimidated to begin with, then that
experience would have never gone down. Exactly.
Exactly. See, it always starts with us, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It always starts with us. And, you know, look, for example, you probably have all kinds of ideas, you know, about very spiritual notions about this and all the rest of it.
Right.
Now, I know,
right.
for example, that you believe these things and it pleases you to believe them. Whether I believe them or not is totally irrelevant. And I would be stupid if I try to say, no, you ought not to be believing that.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? In other words, people
do.
I mean, if you were to say to me, Peter, I'd like to change my point of view about this. Could you help me? Hey, I'd jump right in. But you haven't said that. You're not asking me to change that. What you're asking me is maybe to change other psychological things which you'd like to change, and that's fine. But what I'm driving at is that it's my night for quotes. I'll give you another quote. You know
I love it. I love it.
You know who Lao Tzu is? The founder of Taoism? Lao Tzu.
I know Taoism.
Lao Tzu,
L-A-Z-O or whatever?
L-A-O-T-S-E. Okay.
Okay.
He's the founder of Taoism. Very significant, very impressive philosophy. He says, the good man does not argue. He who argues is not good. He had that right.
Right.
Right? Now, but I can push it further, but I know why they do it. But that statement is, yeah, I mean, if you're arguing and fighting, you have something to prove, right?
Right.
I mean, if you can say with honesty, look, I disagree with you. I can see you have no intention of changing your point of view, and that's got to be okay with me.
Yes.
But I got nothing
to
prove, right? And I think the highest form of wisdom to my mind is even this. I've decided if you can talk to somebody and they have it exactly wrong and you can see that you can't change their point of view and to be at peace with that, that's a high form of enlightenment.
That is my goal. See, that's why I'm like, on some level, if I eliminate the what I call the sand in my oyster, you know, in other words, the top this or because I have some people in my world where what you just said, like I have a dear, dear friend of mine who's diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic.
Okay.
And so from a spiritual point of view, we have many of the same beliefs. And yet on some levels, what I believe, he comes from his mind, and I try to all the time go, no, go from the heart. Now, he'll use words that say he's coming from the heart, but the paradigm that he'll express, I'm like, no, you're still in your mind. You got to go beyond the mind and blah, blah. And my goal is to literally just love him, for exactly who he is, without changing his mind about what he shares with me. I mean, that is absolutely, like, he's one of my beautiful, what I call my beautiful sand. My boyfriend is also a beautiful sand for me, you know, because I really understand that the friction that I'm receiving is helping me be a better being, not just human, but being.
Yeah, so if I had to explain it in my terms, it would be this, okay. So look, you have a point of view. Now, you may have, maybe we can talk about it at length at some point, but when you talk to somebody, you may
absolutely
not be aware of it. Your point, what you're trying, you know what you're doing when you talk to somebody? You may, I'm going to say something odd to you.
Trying to convince them, I think,
yes, you
on
want
some
them to
level
agree with you.
Yes,
right now I'm talking to you with that mindset. I'm saying I want you to agree with what I'm saying. Now, however, before I do that, I've already done something in my own head, which is, but they don't have to, and that puts me at peace.
Yeah,
I'll do my
Peter,
thing.
That's huge.
I'll try to agree with you. I'll try to convince you, and I'm usually quite good at that because I usually know what I'm talking about. But if you don't believe me, I'm not going to give myself a hard time. But I accept the rules of the game, because the rules of the game is this. No matter what you say, no matter how intelligently and well-intentioned you say it, you can never guarantee the other person receiving it. And you accept the rules of the game. Once you do that, there's no argument.
It's brilliant. It's so true. I mean, it's what you just said is just defined where I'm at. Because, see, one of the things, like, from my friend who's schizophrenic, I feel his heart, and I feel he has helped me in some of my saddest times. This other friend with that's doing the top disc, in all honesty, not feeling so much heart. This, you know, it's a relatively new relationship, to be quite honest, and I'm getting the point of, like, you know, I don't need just friction. You know what I mean? Bring me some heart, because that's I resonate with the heart. And those are my teachers. My teachers don't have to be those that agree with me. My teachers are the ones that I feel in my heart and drive me insane in my head.
But you know what I think? You know what I think, Goldie? I think what we gravitate to, I think you and I are similar in this regard. I think a lot of people are like this. What we gravitate to is essential goodness.
Yes.
If you know a person is a generally kind-headed human being, I mean, that's what we're interested in. So whether or not they have these quirks or idiosyncrasies, they're quite peripheral. That doesn't really matter. But see, when you know somebody has a really good heart, that's what unites us with them.
Yes.
And so if they're quirky or whatever it is, who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Well, I mean, I tell people, like, right now I'm trying to get a nanny job. I'm interviewing, and I tell people that my great line this time around is that I'm a mix between Mary Poppins and Pocahontas.
Not bad.
And they laugh, and they like, but, and I tell them, listen, I want you to know I'm eclectic. I am different. I am not, you know, your average nanny, because I'm going to go outside and talk to the trees with your kids, and, you know, I'm going to bring in, I try not to use the word shamanism, because I'm afraid they think I'm going to chop off chicken heads and do blood rituals, you know, for your average, you know, like, millionaire, which is kind of the area, you know, similar to Dick Sales. I'm in Fairfield County, as a nanny. So I kind of want to bring this to them from, like, Walt Disney language, but let them know that, you know, if the kids come in and go, hey, you know, Goldie was talking to the trees, you know, I'm preparing them because I'm going to do that. I just try to, you know, tell them that, listen, what you want is you want somebody that is able to bring in their imagination, because I'm not just with your kids. I'm playing in the land that they're playing in as well. You know, I'll go there. And that's what I'm finding. The more confident I am, this is so interesting, the more confident I am about being who I am, the more they accept it.
The more you dissipate self-distrust, the more, it was the theme of the book, right? That's what we're talking about, right? That's the theme with which we began, right? The more you say, Goldie can trust Goldie, Goldie knows what she's doing, she's not a foolish woman, she makes good choices, she accepts the rules of the game, that's what gives you peace. And everything falls into place. It really has to work.
Yeah.
As I say, I'm not overstating it, you know, really. This question of self-distrust is the killer. As soon as we can talk about it more deeply, but once you understand that really does infect everything we do, then things change radically. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to share one more story, too, which I think really depicts this well. When I first got the radio show 5 years ago, My father used to, well, at the beginning, he would come in. I live with my dad right now, and he would come into my room and go, okay, listen, I'm not giving you any money towards this. This is a pipe dream. It's a crock of shit. I want, you know, I don't think you should be doing it. I can't control you, but don't come to me for anything. So, you know, I would hold up my hands, and I'm kind of used to that on some level with my dad. So I was like, hey, whatever, whatever. And then as time was going on, what I really got clearly was that my father was actually the voice of my own insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, he wasn't coming at me on a everyday basis, but he was really not supportive. And as soon as I kind of like relabeled him, not as a guy trying to take my dream away, but as a guy, you know, the man in my life who's reflecting a subconscious insecurity about myself.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be on terrestrial radio in Rhode Island for the first 3 years.
What kind of a radio station is this? Is it a normal radio station?
No, this is actually internet radio.
Okay, I got you. Go ahead.
Blog Talk Radio, which, by the way, because since going to Blog Talk, this interview will be heard literally in several countries.
Oh, really?
I have fans in Greece, all over the world, and Facebook connected all that. So,
well, that's interesting.
Yeah. It's definitely, I'm global, which was interesting because initially I thought it was a step down, but of course that which we think is one way often turns into, and it was actually a much more expanded fan
base.
So
the reason why I ask is because I have my stepson lives in Connecticut. And I guess, you know, I think he might have wanted to listen to the program, you know. So if he wanted to do that, how would he do that?
He can go to, I can give you my website, which it'll be at the top of the Blog Talk. Like, I have a little thing, a Blog Talk thing, that every week the top show is the last show.
Could you email me that?
Absolutely. Done. Absolutely. And in all honesty, you're going to be a regular. I can already tell. So. I like your style.
Don't forget
to mention
my book, you know, Explaining Unhappiness.
We will. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, and I just want to just let people know that as soon as I made my father an aspect of my own projection, when I left the Rhode Island station and went to Blog Talk Radio, I was actually considering letting the show go, and there was a whole bunch of other stuff that had collapsed, the whole world, and my father actually walked into my room and he was like, "Don't you ever let go of your dreams. He was like, "You're doing a great job."
Yeah.
And I really believe that he was able to shift that because he was the subconscious now telling me what I know today. Don't worry about whether you're terrestrial. Just keep getting the message out because people want to hear.
Well, you know, the quality you have, there's an Italian word. The female is called simpatica. You know, there's something simpatica or simpaticona about you. There's something about you that, you know, I mean, you're likable, to use a very uncomplicated word, you know.
Thank you.
It's a lovely quality, you know. And I think
I'm
very sincere about that, you know. I mean, as soon as you come on the show, okay, I'd like to talk to this lady. it's the feeling.
Well, and, you know, because the whole point is I always feel that the experiences that I've gone through, if they can shed light, again, that gives even deeper purpose. Now, it's already shed the light in my own personal experience, but if I can reach a person, you know, who's basically in drugs and stuff, who have been told you could never change,
mm-hmm.
you know, I want you to know you absolutely can change. This is not about the hand you were dealt with is the hand you got to die with, not even close. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I am absolutely living proof that life is, you can start off on one trajectory.
We all have to believe that, right? If change is,
indeed.
First, everybody believes that, because if change were impossible, nobody would be talking to anybody, nobody would be reading a book. So we all
That's
know
true.
That somehow,
That's
wait
true.
A minute, it's got to be possible.
Right.
You know, why would
right.
we be doing these sorts of things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, Fox News doesn't talk, you know what I mean? The media could be utilized so much differently. You know, now that Rupert Murdoch has, you know, maybe stepped down,
yeah.
perhaps, you know, a change is coming. But, you know, that's what I'm so, you know, we have these kind of radio shows. And, you know, I've actually spoken to some of my listeners through emails, and they're like, "You're doing a great job." And as long as they're happy, but I have teachers that say, if you have something to say, somebody is there to hear it. You know what I mean? There's some... there's a reason why there's a synthesis. I have a desire to speak about these things. I mean, somebody has a desire to hear it. So,
yep.
Hey, rock and roll. Okay, now, definitely tell people about the website and where
website?
They can get the book. Yes, please.
Yeah. Well, the name of the, I have two websites. One is explainingunhappiness.com, and the other one is dissolvingunhappiness.com. And the name of the book is Explaining Unhappiness.
Now, let me ask you.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, what
are you available? Are you available for life coaching?
Yes, I am. Well, the phone number is in the book, also whatever they want to call me, contact me.
Okay, because do phone. I was going to say, do you do phone consultations?
Yeah, I've been doing it for a lot of years. You know, as a matter of fact, you know, I have people in California and Michigan. I mean, yeah, I've been doing that. Yeah, I do. I do a phone consultation. Yeah.
Excellent.
If they want to, you know, if they're interested and they want to talk to me, by all means, come to give me a call.
You want to say your number? Yeah, of course,
yes,
exactly.
631-424-0202. 631-424-0202.
Right on.
Okay.
Right on. Peter,
anyway,
outstanding. Please, Goldie, go ahead.
I can't tell you how much I enjoyed myself, and I'm going to invite you to do something. I have a very interesting thing I think you'd be very interested in. I have a very unusual take on relationships.
Okay.
And I think you will find what I have to say. Well, anyway, we'll talk about it.
I know I will. No. Listen, yes, and I will. I tend to just book in the month.
Okay.
Because life shifts all over the place.
Okay.
I promise you, you'll hear from me. Why wouldn't I? I'd be an idiot not to have you on again. We had a great night.
I can't tell you what I'm thinking. You call me when you're ready, and we'll get together.
Exactly.
Okay.
Love you, Peter. It's a pleasure meeting you, playing with you, speaking with you. You're divine.
It was a pleasure here too, darling.
Namaste. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now.
Okay.
All right, and you can go. I'm just going to play my outro, and next week is, I forget who's on next week, but I believe we're going to be talking about animal totems. So
okay.
I love all you guys. Thanks for listening. Love you, Peter. We'll definitely be in touch with you, definitely.
Okay, thank you, dear.
All right, bless
okay,
you. Bye now.
You've been experiencing Another Reality Show with Golden Hawk. Another Reality Show is live Thursdays 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, or listen and be enlightened anytime that works for you. Questions or comments? Email the show, goldenhawkfeather@yahoo.com. That's goldenhawkfeather@yahoo.com. Also, visit us on the web at www.anotherrealityshow.com. Remember, all you rule breakers, misfits, troublemakers, all you free spirits and pioneers, all you visionaries and nonconformists, everything the establishment has told you is wrong with you is actually what is right with you. You see things others don't. You're hardwired to change the world. And unlike 9 out of 10 people, your mind is irrepressible and you were born to be a revolutionary. And here at Another Reality Show, we salute you. Stay amazing and keep on flying. Good night.